It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. In 1981, James Woodard was sentenced to life in prison for murder. After 27 years of incarceration, Woodard was set free. DNA evidence overturned his conviction, and he was exonerated. Woodard's case was national news. He appeared on 60 Minutes. He was awarded a hefty financial compensation for his imprisonment, but his transition back into life as a free man was not very easy. Joyce King, a Dallas Morning News columnist and broadcast journalist, was involved with Woodard's case as an activist with the Innocence Project. She has written about his overturned conviction, the aftermath, and her personal relationship with James Woodard in a book. It's called Exonerated, A Brief and Dangerous Freedom. And we welcome Joyce King to the program. Joyce, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You were the first non-lawyer to serve on the board of the Innocence Project of Texas. How did you get involved?
I got involved after writing a column for USA Today that the chief counsel for the Innocence Project of Texas saw. He understood immediately my passion for justice, for seeing equal justice done in Texas, and he invited me to become the first non-lawyer. He convinced me that a layperson belonged on the board, and that's how I got started.
Well, James Woodard was convicted of murdering his girlfriend, and he always claimed his innocence. What was your first exposure to his case?
My first exposure was James Woodard's case file came in front of us as a group, and the Innocence Project of Texas began to review that file, and immediately we took a vote, and the vote was unanimous to represent Mr. Woodard, because we all believed 100% with great certainty that this man was innocent. He did not murder his girlfriend, and he was sitting there waiting for someone to help him. So we agreed to pay for his DNA and take him on as a client. That was 2007, and we worked for months, and in April 2008, we helped him win his freedom.
What were some of the major problems with the case against James Woodard?
I think one of the major problems was prosecutorial misconduct. The May 1981 trial showed that there were Dallas investigators who came to prosecutors 1 week before the trial and shared some startling new evidence with them that the murder victim, Beverly Ann Jones, had gotten into a car with three men the night she disappeared. And James Woodard was not one of the three men. I would say that's reasonable doubt right there. That was never shared with his court-appointed defense attorney, so the judge and jury never got to hear this very crucial piece of information. That was evidence that was withheld.
So as you said, the Innocence Project was ready to pay for DNA testing to see if the conviction could be overturned, but Woodard requested this DNA testing, and it was not granted. What were the grounds of denying DNA testing at that time in Texas?
Well, before 2001, it was routinely denied. There was no law on the books until Chapter 64 made it mandatory that if there is evidence available, biological evidence to test, you can't continue to deny these men and women requests for testing such biological evidence. And people have asked me many times, why is Dallas the jurisdiction in the nation that has had more than any other? We've had 25 men exonerated since that Chapter 64 law took effect, 25 men since 2001. And so Dallas actually stored, preserved a lot of biological evidence that dated back to trials from the 1980s and even the late 70s. And in Mr. Woodard's case, there was actually still a rape kit from the murder victim. So we had that DNA to test. And also keep in mind, DNA had not made the scientific strides as of late, back in the 70s and 80s. And so it has just gotten so much better.
So, yes, this has been 27 years since Woodard was imprisoned and his case was overturned due to the DNA evidence. When was the first time you saw him in person? Were you in court with the Innocence Project when he appeared?
Yes, I was, and that's an interesting question because I refused, as we were reviewing his case and studying the documents, I did not want to see any mugshot or photos of Mr. Woodard. I wanted to behold him for the very first time as a free man, and I knew that, you know, we were going to do it. I just knew it. So when James walked into the courtroom on that April day in 2008, that was my first time seeing him seated right behind our defense table. And he looked over, as I tell readers in the book, he looked over and smiled at me for what I thought was 5 seconds too long, just this very intense stare. And I knew then he did not know that I was with the Innocence Project.
So your connection to James Woodard goes beyond your work with the Innocence Project. You ended up becoming engaged. So you say that was the first time you saw him in court and he gave you a look. When did your relationship develop?
2 days later, we were at a fundraiser for the Innocence Project with Morris Deeds, and James literally wanted to go out. He wanted to leave the fundraiser. He wanted to know if I really was on the board of directors. I telling him, yes, I am, Mr. Woodard. And he wanted to know if I would help him write a book. He told me that in prison he had read my first book, Hate Crime, about the Jasper case. And from there, we started talking every time we saw each other. He would do whatever he could to get me to come to his apartment. One thing led to another, and we just found that we were very connected, and we had a lot of destiny connecting us, and I just fell for him. I really did.
When he was released from prison, what was that transition like for him? Did he have people helping him with the transition? Did he have family? It seems like he was ready to get on with his life from the way that you describe his interaction with you.
He was ready to get on with his life. Unfortunately, 27 years in Texas prison had institutionalized James in a way that he was not even aware of. And I saw up close and personal nightmares. He had a lot of prison demons that he dealt with. And I think there was a great deal of frustration. In fact, I know there was, for just dealing with everyday simple things we take for granted. A lot of these men have been gone 2 and 3 decades, and cell phones, internet, all technology is just completely baffling for them. It takes a while to transition, and I had the kind of patience that I could, you know, give to James and share with him and be with him, but it seems all around us he was rushed by the rest of the world. Hurry up and get acclimated. Hurry up and learn how to do this. And he had not learned how to move quite that quickly, mentally, physically, emotionally. He was 27 years old when he was arrested. He was 55 years old when we got him out.
In some ways, parolees have an advantage over the exonerated when it comes to that transition back to life outside prison. Somebody is checking in on parolees. They have to check in themselves. There are benchmarks they have to reach. But this is not so with the exonerated.
That's absolutely right. If you are guilty and you are paroled, you have a parole officer, you qualify for programs that the state is helping you with. You can enroll in computer classes. You qualify for church programs because you are paroled. But the innocent, initially, they did not have anything like that to fall back on because this work is essentially, innocence work is so new. So a lot of them band together, they form groups to, and in Texas there are a lot of them to band together. So they actually have to help each other get along. You asked about family a second ago. Sadly, James only had a half-sister, and they literally did not know each other. They were strangers, and it was a very strange relationship. His mother died while he was in prison. I worked with about 12 exonerees during my time with the Innocence Project, and I remember one had spent 20 years in prison. When he got out, 10 of his family members had died while he was incarcerated. So it literally is, where are we going to go? Who's going to help us? And I just saw a story about two North Carolina exonerees, the two brothers who were exonerated after 30 years. One of them was on death row the whole time. And they have to wait on a pardon from the governor to even be eligible for compensation. So I'm happy to say that in Texas, we do have a pretty good compensation law. It doesn't make the exonerees wait forever to file their compensation. And we try to make sure they get the money very quickly so they can have a place to live, so that they can get psychological counseling and help and everything that they need to get them started.
Now, are there any rules in place that say that the exonerees have to go through counseling? Are there any steps at all that they have to go through to ease in that transition?
No, there aren't any fast, hard rules that say they have to, but we do have programs that finally have been put in place by wonderful volunteers and workers who just really, really admire the exonerees and what they've gone through. They do get a lot of help, as I say, here in Texas from other exonerees who counsel them on what it was like for them when they were exonerated, say, 10 years ago, 5 years ago. So they do get help from their fellow exonerees. But as far as there being a mandatory, you must go to financial counseling. You must go to psychological evaluation. No, it is not mandatory. I only wish that it was after what I saw with James and after what happened to James and how he was taken from me.
Well, I would like to talk about what happened to James in just a moment, but just so people know, you talked about the financial compensation. I imagine people that were following this case in the media saw that James received millions of dollars in compensation for his incarceration. But you say that maybe that was the beginning of the end for him.
I think it absolutely was when I weighed the fact that after he was exonerated in April 2008, the first 18 months, we did not have that money, and I found his progress was a whole lot more focused because he was able to relax and enjoy life with me. We live with my son, and we were making tremendous progress in getting him acclimated back to society, if you will. It was only after the compensation arrived that James found himself completely overwhelmed by people who wanted a piece of that $4.2 million. And he was under pressure to make decisions he was not accustomed to making. And again, I tell you, that's where I think a lot of the prison mentality comes in. These men are only used to structured environments. So I think we have to look at replacing the structured environment, the negative way that they lived, with a more positive structured environment when they are released, so that they have something to do to fill up those empty hours, so that they are learning what life should be like for them post-exonerated. I just read a few days ago that an exoneree actually answers his family when they call out to him, you know, "Where are you?" He still says, "I'm in my cell."
James was in a cell, unfortunately, when he passed away. He died in 2012. He'd been out of prison for 4 years, but he was back in jail at the time he died. What happened?
James had a car crash, the 8th car crash in 4 years. I don't know anyone who could survive 8 car crashes in 4 years. He suffered from seizures. He should never drive, and he and I argued about that a lot. He had had a car accident. Police came to the scene of the accident, working it as that, but they discovered he had a small amount of a controlled substance on him. He was arrested for that and for outstanding warrants that they found. James was carried to jail, Dallas County Jail. He should have been able to bond out in a day or two, but instead he was left there for several weeks, which I have never understood from the lawyers completely. I was looking for James, did not know where he was, that he had been arrested, and I got a phone call that he died of a seizure on the floor of his Dallas County jail cell in October of 2012. James Woodard was 60 years old.
He had developed a lot of health problems that appeared, at least, while he was in prison. Do you think that he was, in a way, feeling like he was living on borrowed time with all of these issues? It seems like he, once he got the money at least, had kind of a self-destructive streak in him. Do you think he ever really truly transitioned out of being in prison?
I think mentally he did not. I think on the exterior, physically and somewhat emotionally, he was able to convince people with this facade that he was better than he was, but they did not know him privately or see what I saw. I think a lot of people thought James was doing a lot better after he got the compensation than he was. I tell readers in the book, I knew about the seizures. He had suffered seizures in prison for 20 years, but they were well managed by Dilantin. But once he got out, and we did run a lot of physicals and we did run a lot of psychological tests on him, we discovered James had high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, which I credited the prison diet probably for that. And he smoked about 2 packs a day. It often felt like I was living with a walking time bomb. And then the car crashes, there were a couple that were pretty severe. He nearly died. I just thought, James, you've used up all 9 of your lives. Stop, because I want you here with me. But he was on this destructive bend. It was almost like he was trying to make up for lost time, which we tell exonerees can never be done.
James Woodard's case was instrumental in helping make some changes in the system. There were things that were challenged that happened to him that were brought forth, and there were changes in the criminal justice system of the state of Texas. What are some of the things that James's case was used as an example of to change the rules?
I'm glad you asked me that, because I don't want his legacy to just be that he died on the floor of Dallas County Jail. James was much loved in this state and across the country for his personality and his willingness to work hard and to advocate. He, of course, was part of the contingent that persuaded lawmakers to pass the Timothy Cole Compensation Act. In 2011, he helped persuade lawmakers to pass the double-blind sequential law, which has to do with the way photo and live lineups are done. So I was very, very proud of him. In 2009, we went to New York. James helped 60 Minutes win a Murrow Award for a segment about him, and he was the only one to receive a standing ovation in the room that night. He was so humble and so learned. He knew he was making a lot of mistakes, but he also did a lot to inspire law students to choose criminal law, to choose to do innocence work, to choose to have a passion about helping the less fortunate, helping poor people who might not have a good defense. So James left a legacy of more than just, you know, a man who was on a rampage. He actually suffered a lot. And so we now also have the Michael Morton Law, which deals with prosecutorial misconduct. So Texas is trying to correct some of the injustices of the past.
Joyce King's book about James Woodard and her life with him is called Exonerated, A Brief and Dangerous Freedom. Joyce King, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.